Welcome to Insta Poetic Justice, the first podcast of its kind discussing the ever-evolving terrain of poetry and technology and how these two have merged together to create the subgenre that is Insta Poetry. Here I will interview poets about poets as we weigh in on the positives and negatives of this new literary phenomenon. I'm your host, Amy Sophia Mayer. You can check out my poetry books at www.paganpoetess.com. Supporting me via my published works is the best way to ensure all these podcasts remain free and accessible to everyone. And now, on with the show. Welcome back, poetry lovers. This is another episode of Insta Poetic Justice. I'm your host, Amy Sophia Mayer, and today I'm joined by the poet Hashim.
Hello.
Some of you may know Hashim on Instagram, aka at TrueHashim. When I first reached out to him for this podcast, he had roughly 75,000 followers, and now at the time of this recording, he has achieved nearly 100,000 followers. As always, his info will be in the description box of this episode so you can check out his latest works. So, are you ready, Hashim?
Yes, of course.
Wonderful. Again, thank you so much for joining me in my humble poetry podcast.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Of course. So first, what I like to ask all my poets is, you know, where are you from? Like, what do you do outside of poetry? Just give us a brief summary of who is Hashim.
All right. So I'm from a very, very small island all the way in the Middle East, in the Arabian Gulf. It's called Bahrain. And I'm a student of international relations and political science, not in my country, but I study in Turkey.
Oh, okay.
So while recording now, I'm basically in the capital of Turkey, Ankara.
Oh, you're in Ankara? I have not visited Ankara yet. I did do a master's in Istanbul, but I never got to visit Ankara, unfortunately.
Istanbul is beautiful.
So are you at the Middle Eastern Technical University?
It's in Bilkent University, a private university.
Oh, okay.
So I speak Arabic and English only. I'm 22 years old, and I really love poetry. Poetry is one of my favorite hobbies, more like a lifestyle, we could say. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I guess that's it.
Yeah, wonderful. You haven't learned any Turkish yet?
Honestly, not yet. Even though the language would be easier for me to learn, since many words are originally Arabic, but mm-hmm. I guess it's just my laziness kicking in.
Yeah, no, that's what I actually learned Arabic before I learned Turkish. And so when I was learning Turkish, and I'm like, oh my God, I know almost all these words because I studied Arabic beforehand. And then I also started learning Ottoman Turkish, which uses the Arabic alphabet. And there were some words that even the native speaker Turks could not understand. And I could only understand it because I had studied Arabic for so long.
Such an advantageous feeling.
Yeah. So you describe poetry as a sort of like lifestyle and one of your favorite hobbies. So is there any specific thing that started getting you into poetry? Like how did that hobby develop?
I wouldn't really be able to tell or give an origin of the inspiration behind the poetry that I give now, except mm-hmm. that it naturally developed as a way of perceiving life. Or a way of perceiving what's around me. When mm-hmm. I look at a tree, for example, I'll just come up with words about a tree. If you notice the context of my poetry, mm-hmm. it's always random and usually contains elements of, you know, simple daily life, just romanticized. So mm-hmm. I could say what inspired me to engage in poetry would be my own nature, we could call it nature. Mm-hmm. A natural lifestyle, and throughout my studies which include poetry, I've come across a lot of individuals, let's say historically, and most favorably Rumi, which I'm pretty sure everybody knows in the poetry realm.
Of course, Rumi, and of course my husband is Persian, although he does prefer Hafez over Rumi, but yeah.
Both are really, you know, poetic magicians, I could say.
Indeed. So, I one thing that really drew me to your Instagram page is that you present your poems
as bilingual. You have them both in Arabic and in English. And, you know, I've interviewed other poets on this podcast who are not native speakers of English, but they keep their poems that they, at least the ones they put on Instagram, as an English. So what was the reasoning behind wanting to present the poems in both Arabic and English?
I find the language, both languages actually, Arabic and English, beautifully fluent when expressing poetic terms. Like, the terminology in English has its own beautiful way of expressing emotions, and with Arabic it's the same case. Like, there are varieties of depths, we could say, that both these languages would be diving to. Secondly, about audience as well. In the Islamic world, many people, especially even if they don't know Arabic, but have languages such as Persian or Urdu that have Arabic letters, they love to try and learn way of speaking poetic Arabic.
Mm-hmm.
So you could say that the way my poetry is introduced is a means for learning Arabic, a means for romanticizing the English that I'm offering as poems, and a way to harvest the Arab culture, we could say.
Wonderful. Yeah, I think that's a really interesting perspective, because so often, you know, just by the nature of English coming to dominate the world as the lingua franca and the means of multiple groups communicating with each other, in some ways that has culturally diluted, you know, the perception of English as a sort of cultural language, if you will. Like, certainly I know a lot of non-native speaker of Arabic, non-native speakers of English, who view English just as a means to an end, you know, to operate in the global market. They don't really see the beauty of it in of itself. So, you know, going back to, you know, your poems are bilingual, like, you know, are they originally written in Arabic or English, one or the other, and then you bring the translation, or like, how does that process work, or does both happen?
Honestly, it's quite a diverse process. Sometimes my poetry pops up in my head in English. Sometimes it pops in Arabic. Usually, when my brain creates words or phrases in English, it would be harder to poeticize the words into Arabic. Like, it would be harder for me to find the words. But when I come up with words directly in Arabic, with the words I plan on choosing, which my brain constructs, especially since Arabic has basically a big basket of words which could be used for poetry, then it's easier for me to translate it to English. So we could say it's a bilateral effect from my side.
Wonderful. And before I ask the next question, I need to explain to our listeners that, you know, there is a very wide discrepancy between what is considered formal written Arabic and what is spoken colloquial Arabic. And there are specific terms for this, like very formal modern standard Arabic is referred to as Fusha. And then colloquial Arabic, what people like speak in everyday life and in the streets, is known as Amia. So all the poems that I've seen so far on your Instagram page have been in Fusha, in very formal Arabic. But I wanted to ask, do you ever write poetry in Amia?
I don't write poetry in Amia, but the reason being behind that is because, you know, Amia could be limited to the people of a certain territory. Because, for example, Egyptians, they wouldn't understand a few words from Bahraini if I wrote poetry in a local manner, like domestic manner. But when I write it in Fusha, you could realize that, first of all, it's prettier, like it's more, you could say, more fluent. You can sense the beauty in it. It's more organized, more arranged than Amia Arabic. That's the reason why I choose the classical form of Arabic over the slang form of Arabic within some countries.
Okay. Yeah, no, I was just really curious about that because, you know, certainly like in, you know, Arabic pop music, it's always, you know, in Amia, whether that's Egyptian or, yeah, because obviously as a foreigner, I first started learning, you know, modern standard Arabic, Fusha, but then as I got older, the dialect that I'm most proficient at is Moroccan Arabic, Darija, which probably means if you spoke in Bahraini, I would understand very little because they would be so different.
That's true. There's a big difference.
Alrighty then. So also, here's another question. I'm curious, you know, the Arabic language, like Persian, it has a very rich history of poetry within the culture. And I think a lot of Westerners do not fully understand, you know, that poetry is so much more mainstream in Middle Eastern cultures than they are in modern Western cultures. So I wanted to ask you, has traditional Arabic poetry had any influence on your work?
On my work, my work as like
as a poet,
As a poet, yes, of course. We're basically taught the oldest versions of Arabic since we were kids. We're supposed to learn about them, and sometimes we use them in daily life, in matters that are governmental, for example, or even poetic. Our poetry classes, and calligraphy classes as well, as we call the poetry on paper. The art of poeticizing the design of words, that's also classical. So I would say the effects would be like any effects in other Arab countries who would learn or teach the classical version of Arabic since a younger generation. And one more point, we learn the Arabic letters sometimes starting without the dots. So you could imagine it would be just lines. So that would be that goes way back.
Interesting. I cannot not imagine learning Arabic without the dots. Then how do you know which letter is which?
Intuition.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, as a non-native speaker, I would fail at that miserably.
Inshallah, you can learn.
Yeah. So I've noticed that in your poems, Islam is quite a major component in terms of the themes of your poetry on your page. So what inspired you to lean into your religion and your spirituality as to be a major focus of your poetry?
I found it quite appealing for my audience first. And since my interest took to religious books, I started reading religious books quite a year and a half ago. And just a point, before this, I used to have romantic poetry on my page. Those are archived, but since now I post only Islamic literature, the reason for that is my increased interest in the Arabic language, because I didn't write in Arabic before on my page, and making my page God-centric attracted more people, and I could say naturally I just fell for, you know, creating some sort of romance or poeticizing the relationship between man and God. That was an interest. Just developed.
Nice, wonderful. So, in addition to religion, like, do you use your poetry at all to discuss any sort of social or political issues within the Arab world? Because that's another major component of why poetry in the Arab world is so prominent, because it's often used as a tool to discuss ongoing issues such as the conflict between Israel and Palestine, or the issues of, you know, sectarian conflict between Sunni and Shia. So have you ever branched into, you know, discussing these sort of issues in your poetry?
Actually, yes, sometimes. Poetry is widely, as you said, it's widely used in politics or religion. So there's a way of using art in describing political opinions. I have some poems that talk about that, which I've archived because of governmental policies. And since I've adopted those policies personally now, so the political aim of some of my poems would be unity. And since unity is also acceptable by the government, like the way unity is achieved, unity is a theme of a few of my poems, actually. So you could say politics, yes, not specified politics, like specific intergovernmental relations between among countries, but you could say a general sense of unifying people. The religion, Sunni and Shia, I wouldn't mention them explicitly in a poem, but I would mention unity or Islamic unity.
I see. Wonderful. So, you know, in Bahrain, specifically where I am in the United States, the coronavirus has gotten, you know, quite bad. Like, I'm going to be working from home for the foreseeable future. Has global events such as the coronavirus pandemic influenced your poetry or maybe just your writing process? And if so, how?
The only way COVID-19 affected my way of writing is I feel like I have extra time to contemplate about things around me. Mm-hmm. If you realize from my page, my recent poetry was included lots of mental health, self-help, and included solitude, themes of solitude, and beautifying solitude. I realize that now. I didn't realize that when the virus spread. But after looking back at my poetry, I realized that I unconsciously changed my way of writing words or coming up with phrases, poetic phrases. So yes, it impacted my way of writing positively.
Oh, okay. So you definitely seem to be the type that you won't explicitly discuss things, you know, maybe certain issues that are going on in the world, but from those, you'll take those current events as prompts as for wider abstract ideas in your poetry, such as, again, self-help or unity and, you know, things like that.
Yes.
Alrighty then. Wonderful. So, you know, you're gaining quite a bit of a following on Instagram. Like, do you have any plans to publish your own poetry collection, be that in Arabic or in English?
Yes, actually soon. I'm looking for a publishing company here in Turkey.
Okay.
I'm planning on dividing my poetry into like page to page abstracts in a book.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a name for the books. I plan on naming it Hashim's Letters to convey a sense of personal connection between me and the reader.
Okay, wonderful. And yeah, you're still looking for a publisher in Turkey for that?
Yeah, or abroad. I mean,
yeah. And will it be bilingual Arabic English or one or the other?
Bilingual.
Okay, wonderful. I can't wait. When you get that published, make sure to let me know because I will be most interested in it.
Of course, that's very sweet of you.
Okay. Alrighty then, a last question I wanted to ask. Like, who is your favorite, like, contemporary Arab poet? Mine personally is Nizar Qabbani.
Ah, Nizar Qabbani. Mm-hmm. Contemporary poets.
Yeah.
Alright. So, I don't have a specific list of recent individuals specializing in poetry.
Mm-hmm.
But I have, for example, politicians who have poetry as a hobby and would beautifully construct their words, their political ideas in poems. And one of those people is Barzugh Al-Ghanem. He's the head of parliament in Kuwait.
Oh, okay.
So I could say he's my favorite. Currently, mm-hmm. he's my favorite poet. And historically, I could say many of the Sufi poets have some of the most beautiful poetry, which inspires me.
Ah, yes, the Sufis. Mm. Wonderful. Alrighty then. Well, thank you so very much. And now we can move on to the recitation of your poem. So would you like to share one of your poems with us, please?
Yeah, of course. So, as you know, my poems don't have titles. I would just throw in words. My first poem is... Seasons teach you that you can be beautiful, even if flowers are not growing around you. The moon teaches you that you can be complete, even when you are going through different phases. Plants teach you that you can be strong, even if you are as helpless as a seed bird in the soil. God made your world a school and gave you teachers that do not speak, but still teach you the beauty of the smile you have, a smile that God considers a precious deed.
Wonderful. Yeah, I really like the sentiment. It's not the first time I've heard it, but I always love that sentiment of using the moon as a sort of symbolism that, you know, you don't have to always be complete, if you will, to be beautiful. Again, the symbolism of the moon going through various, you know, stages.
Mm.
Yeah. Alrighty, would you like to share your next poem, please?
Yeah, of course. My next one is, it is said that a worry was cleansed by a tear, and that a heart was revived in prostration, and that a dream was fulfilled by a prayer. That is the beauty of life with God.
Nice, wonderful. Again, so very Again, very pious and very devout.
Of course.
Yeah. All right, then. Would you like to recite your last poem, please?
You may be saddened by the few empty spaces in your heart, but remember that empty spaces in gardens grow the prettiest flowers when watered. So water those spaces with love and compassion towards yourself.
I really enjoy that one because, you know, we think of having holes in our heart, but at the same time, if we just give them a little care, they can bring the most wonderful flowers. Yeah, I really like that one.
Thank you very much. A mixture of piousness and self-care, I could say.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, I like it. So, alrighty then. So now we can move on to basically the discussion about John Lupin, who is the major Instapoet that you and I will be discussing. And I was able to find, I'm going to read a brief intro of him. You know, I actually purchased his book, Encyclopedia of a Broken Heart. And so John Lupin is a writer, husband, and father. He shares his stories the best way he knows how, with poetry. John lives in the suburbs of Vancouver, Canada, with his wife, Rose, his three children, and his dog. And a personal quote from him, from John Lupin, is, I am an alcoholic with 3 years of sobriety and write about my journey through sobriety while living with OCD. So yeah, so it definitely seems for him, poetry was a means of healing from his alcoholism and his, like, addiction.
Mm-hmm. I see. In an artistic way.
Yes, indeed. Which is, again, definitely a better way. Again, I always prefer creative outlets over, illegal substances.
All right. I understand.
Yeah. So, alrighty then. So again, at this point, you know, we can go back and forth in, you know, the poems from John Lupin that we picked. And I can start again. All of my poems are from this book, Encyclopedia of a Broken Heart. And one of the ones I picked was on page 47 of that book, and here, I'll read it now. It's called Figure. Life without you is a figure in the dark, a darkness that follows me down every lit path, enveloping all good things, leaving the mark of the beast, or what seems like a dastardly deed that has yet to be known. It's a catastrophe that hasn't happened yet, but it's on repeat in my mind. Every eye closed is an admission that I know it's an inevitability. But one day, I figure that specter of losing you will vanish and I'll be able to live with my future again.
Impressive.
Yeah. So I liked that again, just the sense of life without you and just that sort of darkness. Like, it is a... I love his use of the word inevitability. Like, I don't know. I can't go into super deep analysis of why I like it so much. I just do.
And there's this glimpse of hope in the end as well, the end of the poetry. It gives you the sense where the poet is trying to achieve a hopeful ending by speaking of a future.
Again, indeed. One day I'll be able to live with my future again. Yes, he does end on that hopeful note. So would you like to share one of the ones that you picked, please?
All right. So I picked Betrayal from the same book which you've quoted. I write poems about you with my eyes closed. I can bear the sight of the words and the shape of the sentences, but they find a way to form themselves into the shape your body leaves behind in my bed. It is easier on the eyes if I am blind to your betrayal now then, and every time I grab a pen.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, no. I think that's, I think it shows the definite human nature of when we're betrayed by someone we care about so much, like, it's very hard for our, like, brain to process it, and we go through, like, a stage of, like, denial, or either denial, or if not outright denial, then some sort of, you know, perverse justification for it, because we just don't want to, our brain isn't quite able to accept the reality of, yes, they did something bad.
And the way he expresses himself in deepening the, trying to express the thoughts, the effects of the thoughts he's thinking of. Like, I write my poems about you with my eyes closed. A deep sense of thought. And I really like that about the poems. He shows that in multiple other pieces of his poetry. And I think that's really beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. So here, again, from the same book, I chose one on page 135, which is called, a short one, called Summer's Day. Wings of silver, a heart of gold, bronze skin, and sapphire eyes. On a summer's day, you always felt like treasure.
Lovely.
Yeah, again, I don't know. I just like the combination of the three metallics, gold, silver, bronze, and then with the sapphire eyes, like, and the treasure. I don't know. Seems, in the grand scheme of things, the imagery might be a little simple and maybe used, but I really enjoyed it.
I fully agree. He shows this theme in, again, multiple of his in pieces of his poetry, and they give you that impression about the way he combines words and the impression of the way he expresses them. Mm-hmm. Trying to send a message. I feel like he's trying to send a message of what he's feeling and wants the audience to exactly understand what he wants to convey. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So would you like to share one of your poems then?
My poems?
Huh. Like, yeah, the poems that you picked, of John Lupin's that you picked.
He has this, it doesn't have a page, but it's called Clang. Mm-hmm. Nothing was more awkward for me than the clinking of teacups, the clang of fork and knife, pot and pan, the grinding of teeth, a grainy wash of glances stolen across a table I was sure would burst apart, killing the lot of us with wooden shards while waiting for you to remember how to greet me with a kiss.
Interesting. I really like that one, just especially just the clanking of teacups, because again, I've lived in the Middle East so long, like tea is such an integral part of like the culture of hospitality and socializing and conversation. So the idea that you're engaging in something that's so desperately, you know, the whole symbolism of it is to bring like people together to talk and everything, but still there's this barrier of no one wants to talk to each other or, you know, discuss what the issue is.
Fully beautifully explained about a beautiful poetry. But I feel like there is a sense of, you know, I feel like there's a sense of discomfort from his side while writing the poem. Like when he says, when he mentions the wooden shards and while waiting for you to remember how to greet me with a kiss, it feels like a sense of impatience and desire for something.
Alrighty then. Here, let me see. Next poem I picked was on page 95. And here it's called Metal. I know sometimes it looks dark out there, that the light doesn't shine as bright as it used to, or in the places that it needs to. I know the steps leading to the heavens are fraught with cracks and worn with traps. This life is but a test of your mettle, my dear, and I'm going to need you to pass with flying colors. Yeah.
That gave me a happy feeling.
Yeah, no, if anything, I don't know if he was doing this purely, you know, in a romantic sense, you know, like the trials of within a relationship, but just in regards to your poetry, and because your poetry is heavily influenced by Islam, it made me interpret this in a very religious sense of, you know, the trials of this life as we go on, you know, to the afterlife.
That's how I interpret it as well.
Mm-hmm. All right, would you like to recite the next poem, please?
Yeah, it's called Capable. It should never surprise you what I'm capable of when it comes to overcoming the deepest cuts to my ever-present heart. As crazy as I might seem, I'm just trying to make sure it looks good sitting high up on my sleeve, while looking down upon the downtrodden fools who tried and failed to love you as quick stalkly as I have. I feel like it wants to express some sort of jealousy towards other people who tried to love the woman that he loved, mm-hmm. but couldn't get to her.
I like the idea. I like the use of the word as crazy as I might seem, because just especially with, you know, culturally in the West, there's a history of, you know, men dismissing women or maybe women's like grievances within relationships as just being crazy and hysterical. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of people just missing the point that a lot of behaviors we deem crazy or hysterical are coming from a place of deep pain or frustration.
Exactly. So I'm glad there are certain images, social inspirations probably behind these poems. As you just explained, a cultural phenomenon. I think he tries to implement those or express or maybe portray those social elements in his poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe to counter certain elements that shouldn't be in the societal construct.
Right, right. Wonderful. Yes, alrighty then. And then the next one I'm going to read is on page 26, and it's called Cold. Shattered like a teacup, in love with concrete. Deaf like a heart, breaking with no sound. Vanished like a love song written in the water. These disappointments all pointed to one simple, cold, hard fact. The weight of doing anything that must have meaning is more than anyone can bear. Yeah, and again, I really like his use of, like, the teacups. Like, that's now the second poem we've read that he uses, like, as sort of the clanking or shattering of teacups.
Mm. I noticed the teacups as well, and I loved how he talks about, you know, he connects different phenomenons into one using words.
Mm-hmm.
For example, vanishing and on the water, words on the water, how it vanishes. It explains his sentiments in a vanishing of thought.
Mm-hmm.
That's what interests me, other than the teacups, of course.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and I really liked the last few lines, the weight of doing anything that must have meaning is more than anyone can bear. And again, just going into the typical sentiment of anything that's worth having or worth doing takes hard work.
Exactly. Exactly. He has multiple factions of, or let's say multiple divisions of his poetry express several things, but in the end, they come back to the same message.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful perspective poem.
Yeah. And then would you like to read the next one?
Yes. A blessing. I don't think we've done blessing, right?
I don't think so.
Blessing, it can get quite annoying when you're hurting to be told to look for the blessing in the pain. Let me just part the red sea of tears and look for the amazing shore that awaits on the other side. That's simply not possible, at least not until I'm sure I'm on dry ground.
Again, a lot of imagery from the Abrahamic religions with the Red Sea.
The Red Sea and his way of expressing pain and annoyance of the way people try to, you know, try to express positivity.
Right.
This is one point I usually express in my poetry, which tells the reader to find the blessing in the error. I feel like he gets annoyed by that type of advice a person would give.
Yeah. And I can kind of understand that annoyance. Like, you know, I am no longer Christian, but I remember when I was Christian, and just in general, like, still my favorite story from the Bible and likewise the Quran is, you know, the story of Yosef.
Mm.
And the idea, you know, that he went through so much hardships, but at the end he ended up, you know, doing okay. And, you know, I took great comfort in that story. Now that I'm no longer Christian, I sort of think, you know, yes, there are some errors or pain that I can sort of see the lesson in, but there also have been times where I've gone through pain and I'm just like, there is no lesson in here. This was stupid. This shouldn't have happened. But yeah.
I understand fully.
Yeah. Alrighty then, and I will read the last poem, and this is on page 152, called Vampires. Blood will always course through us, making us visible and tasty for the vampires who live under our beds, in our closets, in our school desks, in our phones, in our dreams, in the bedeviled little places we keep secret from our parents, in the space between the heart and the soul. The harder we try to hide, the more visible we become. So it might be best to just be out with it.
Lovely. Mashallah.
Yeah. No, I like it because, first of all, I love, like, the myth of vampires. In fact, my own poetry collection, if I ever finish it, my next one will be, it's called The Vampire in the Mirror. So I like the imagery of when poets use vampires, and especially because, you know, there are a lot of people and things within our society that, you know, drain our emotional, our energy and our labor. So in a way, they are sort of emotional vampires within the society. But yeah.
A very lovely explanation. I'm glad you're including this in the next collection because I really can't wait for it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. And then I like the idea of he's expressing, like, the more you try to hide something, the more it just becomes visible. And I'm pretty sure for him personally, that's this sentiment is coming from, again, his struggles with maybe alcoholism or addiction. And the more maybe he tried to hide it, the more blatantly obvious it became to, like, his family and people around him.
His direct portrayal of something really interests me. The way he expresses those idea, especially using vampires as a phenomenon in the poem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm. All right, then. Well, thank you so much for, I think we had a wonderful discussion analyzing his poems. Like, yeah, he is definitely one of my favorites.
I agree. And I actually thank you for introducing me to his poetry, because I've taken a lot of interest in what he has to say and the way he expresses things.
Mm-hmm.
I've gone through his Instagram, and the book you just mentioned is a book that I'm planning on getting as well.
Mm-hmm.
I've read a part of it, and I think it deserves, you know, it deserves attention.
Yeah, indeed. I made the investment in buying the book along with several of the other books for the sake of research for this podcast. And yeah, alrighty then. So now we can move on to the critical part of the podcast, and this will be a little different, like, you know. What I usually do, as for listeners who have listened to other episodes, they know that what I typically like to do in this section is I take either an article criticizing the poet or a maybe 1 or 2 star review from Amazon and I'll read it. But unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, it's not like I want people to be saying bad things about his poetry, but I just really could not find any sort of criticism specifically about John Lupin. And so because of that, like, in terms for this section of the podcast, I decided that I'm going to read some excerpts of a very famous article that was criticizing Insta poetry in general. So for us, we'll be discussing, like, just general criticism of Insta poetry and, you know, whether we agree with them or not, not specifically about John Lupin, because I apologize. I literally couldn't find anything.
That's good news.
Yeah, well, that's good, because, you know, typically, you know, I went to Amazon.com to look at the reviews for his book, and none of them were, like, 1 star or 2 star. Like, they were all at least 3 stars, and I'm like, oh, well, these people like him.
That's actually very impressive. Like, I have nothing for that.
Indeed. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read a few. I actually wrote a whole article about this, but there was a article written by, I believe her name was Rebecca Watts, and she wrote an article that was a very scathing condemnation of all Insta poetry. And so I'll read a few of the quotes from that article, and then we can talk about them.
All right, that one's brutal.
Yeah, it was really brutal. It was like, I think it was called Insta Poetry and, like, the Cult of the Noble Amateur. Yeah, that's what it, yeah, it was basically called that.
Wow.
Yeah. So here's one quote from that article. Why is the poetry world pretending that poetry is not an art form? I refer to the rise of a cohort of young female poets who are currently being lauded by the poetic establishment for their honesty and accessibility, buzzwords for the open denigration of intellectual engagement and rejection of craft that characterizes their work.
Well, wow.
Yeah, so what does that make you think of? Like, basically, she's saying that, you know, the poetry establishment is not doing enough to criticize, you know, in essence, she doesn't use the term specifically here, but basically Insta poets. And, you know, her perception that the sort of, you know, honesty and accessibility that have contributed to these Insta poets' popularity, that's basically, you know, the simplification of the art form has, you know, basically destroyed poetry. So what do you think about that?
I mean, she basically described the entire line of Insta poets as, you know, an amateur stage. I guess that shouldn't be, you know, it shouldn't be a generalization. I don't know if she meant it as a generalization as of all the Insta poets out there, but I believe there are some, you know, really great, for example, John Lupin and others you've mentioned in the emails. There are many people who use Instagram and other means of social media to, you know, showcase their poetry. And sometimes poetry expressed by Insta poets can outperform the poetry of, like, very much classical poets who tend to leave their poetry out of Instagram and use it in a classical manner. We could say she basically favors a classical way of poetry over a modern approach of poetry.
Yeah, basically, yeah, she encompasses And she's really angry and bitter about the fact that modern, like, Insta poetry is eclipsing classical poetry in terms of its popularity and its visibility, and therefore wants to delegitimize the entire, like, platform of using Instagram for poetry as a type of, you know, if you put your poetry on Instagram, it's not real poetry. Yeah, and there was a point where she was supposed to review another, like, Insta poet's works, but she hears her quote, "I was supposed to be reviewing the poetry, but to do so for a poetry journal would imply that it deserves to be taken seriously as poetry." So she is so condescending towards Insta poetry that she cannot even bring herself to, like, engage with it, like, for better or for worse as real poetry. Like, I feel like if she... It's one thing you can claim that poetry is either good or bad. You can argue for that because, again, writing is subjective and you can make cases for either side. But to put yourself in this position that you get to decide, like, what is poetry, it's the same as, like, trying to define what is art. Like, no one can do that.
Exactly. As if she's trying to construct an ideological approach towards the theme of modern poetry. Maybe her way, I think what she's criticizing is, I don't know if she's criticizing basically the content, the agency of words, because, like, poetry is more about a process of thinking and creating words, as some might define it. So I guess she's not only criticizing a genre of poetry, but she's criticizing an entire approach, which even classical poets would agree with. I feel like there are many classical poets who would agree with Insta poetry.
Right. And then one thing that really put, here's another quote. She equates basically the popularity and the large following of Insta poetry and Insta poets. Like, she's comparing their popularity with the sort of how Donald Trump used social media to gain his following, and trying to say that just because something gains traction on social media doesn't necessarily make it good. So what she says is, Twitter co-founder Evan Williams registered his dismay at how social media platforms were helping to dumb the entire world down, lamenting specifically the role Twitter played in Donald Trump's election victory. So I just really don't like the way she's equating, like, Insta poetry as a phenomenon with Donald Trump and his use of social media. Like, what do you think about that?
I think it's funny, especially that it's, you know, Donald Trump. Not just any politician. I mean, like, speaking of popularity is, I mean, in classical times, we could say, since without the presence of social media, poets used to get their own audience by performing in public.
Mm-hmm.
And performing in public, in many occasions, did not require them to first sign up for a competition or anything. They just came up painfully, as the case with Arab poets, or just my favorite poet, Ghanem al-Marzouq. He just walks up in parliament and gives out a poem without, you know, even if it's not about poetry. So I feel like poetry, Insta poets are doing the same thing. They're just coming out, they're handing out their poetry, they're expressing themselves. And the audience, in the end, is a group of legitimate people who are interested in the words of the person.
Mm-hmm.
And poetry can take many forms, whether it's, like, rhymes, whether it's metaphors or basically connecting words. Poetry can take forms. So I think her criticizing the way of Insta poets is criticizing another version of classical poetry as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, you know, I think her whole point in comparing the Insta poetry phenomenon with Donald Trump gaining his following is she's trying to delegitimize, like, Insta poetry already doesn't have the sort of quote-unquote legitimacy or merit that classical poetry claims to have. Like, its only sort of credence is its level of popularity, with some of these poets having millions and millions of followers. And so even she's trying to delegitimize that following by saying that just because something gains a large following, like Donald Trump, that doesn't make it good.
Mm.
Yeah. So yeah, I actually wrote an article about this specific critical article, and here I'll read just one paragraph that I wrote in response to this article. So already Watts is painting herself into a corner by claiming she is in a privileged position to dictate what is and is not art. I would take her more seriously if she framed her argument by explaining why insta-poetry is bad poetry rather than try to pin an impossible definition on art and poetry. To be frank, the image that came to mind was a petulant child. By starting off so strongly and negatively, she immediately becomes an easy target for accusations of literary snobbery. She could have easily avoided this obvious lens of elitism and given more credit to her criticisms by engaging with the material in a calmer fashion.
Beautifully said. And
yeah.
I agree. I fully agree.
Mm-hmm.
She wouldn't be able to provide, you know, a construct of evidence of why Insta-poets have to be delegitimized. Maybe the following. Yes, if a person has like millions, it doesn't mean that the person would be better than someone with only 6 followers or like, you know, 1 follower.
Mm-hmm.
But still, in her way of generalizing the entire poetry or the entire platform of Insta-poets would be like an attack of on poetry itself. Because if you compare, if you compare the poetry, Insta-poetry, to classical poetry, the way of processing the words and the means of which a person conveys the message, the way of a person spreads their poetry, it could be like similar to the old ways, just with new technology, you know?
Yeah, and I agree 100%. Like, there's just this, I don't know, for whatever reason, they don't see technology being used as a continuation of an art form. They see technology as destroying art forms. Whereas, you know, I like to think that, you know, we cannot ignore the influence of technology on language, what with texting and typing and everything, that just, you know, I think we should be embracing how it changes, you know, changes ourselves linguistically rather than just, you know, looking at the sense of nostalgia of the old ways. Like, we can appreciate both the old and the new.
Exactly. That's where I fully agree with you.
Yeah. Alrighty then. Well, thank you so much for joining me in that exercise. And now we'll move on to a more happy exercise with the exercise called hashtag InstaPoetry. So, do you have your phone ready?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, so I want you to go to Instagram and just search for the hashtag InstaPoetry.
Hashtag InstaPoetry.
And so what you'll do is you'll just pick a poem at random, whichever one that speaks to you, and then you'll read it aloud, and then we'll talk about them. So here, I'll start with, I found one poem.
All right.
Let's see. Okay. One is from Poetry's Gram, like that page, and it says, "Dating in this generation is pointless because everyone is either stuck on their ex or broken from old shit they can't let go." Yeah, I would not. Again, one criticism of InstaPoetry that I will concede to is, you know, the lines between quotes and poems become blurred. And to me, this is much more of a quote than like a poem.
I see. I agree.
Yeah. So you can pick one now.
So there's this by Poet Special.
Mm-hmm.
Poet Special account. "Dear self, I am sorry for breaking you. I know it took you years to fix. It took you years to fix the damage. I promise I am learning to be gentler. It is more complicated than I thought."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I would say it's, again, I can't really distinguish between, like, clearly distinguish between a quote and poetry, but I feel like it has a sense of both.
Mm-hmm.
This one. And especially since, like, it says, like, it shows that the person who, or phenomenon that gave this quote is patience. Mm-hmm. But patience says, "Dear self, I am sorry for breaking you." I feel like that's an artistic way of performing poetry.
Yeah, it's certainly, I found the poem, I'm looking at it and how, like, the stanzas are separated. So, yeah, this definitely falls in the poetry category to me as well.
Mm.
Alrighty then, let me see. Let me try and find another one. Oh, When everything gets quiet, the only thing left speaking to you is your heart. You will never be able to escape the stillness of that which your heart truly wants. And this is from In Our Heart in London.
Mm, I like
yeah.
it.
Yeah, no, I like her. I'm actually familiar with her work. I think I am following her. And I think I did actually reach out to her to see if she wanted to be a guest. But she has yet to respond to me. But that's okay.
Mm. Hopefully she responds well.
Yeah. Alrighty, would you like to choose another one, please?
Oh, this is from someone I'm actually following. It just appeared to me on the hashtag.
Mm-hmm.
By Sai Asari, Dawn's Fragrance, Instagram. When did your name change from a proper noun to a prayer? That's all I whisper the whole day long.
Oh, I really like that one. Like, again, with just changing from proper noun to prayer. I really like that. That sort of transformative element.
Mm, it's really nice. I like it as well. It doesn't have lines in between, as you mentioned earlier. But, mm-hmm. you know, the rhetoric of expressing words kind of shows the art, you know?
All right, then. Oh, no, who just read the poem? You or me?
Me.
Okay. So, yeah, so here I found another poem. And it's by J. Warren Welch. And what is it? It's called, has no title. She makes me lock the doors at night, and I sleep better knowing she really believes there might be something out there worse than me.
I like the theme. Theme is beautiful.
Yeah, no, I like the theme because it's, you know, it's kind of the idea of, oh, how do I describe it? Just the idea that, you know, deep down, like, you know, no one is more critical of ourselves than we ourselves are. And so just the idea that we think we're so bad and the fact that, you know, we take comfort in people thinking that there are worse people than us out there.
Mm, beautiful, way, really beautiful.
Yeah. All right. Would you like to read one more, please?
Yeah, of course. So this one's by D Blogs from Mumbai. The house was his, but he was my home. The speaker played his song loud. My song was his heart's beat.
Mm.
I like
it.
The sense of romance in this, the way she connects, the way she expresses how everything around her is his, but he is basically hers. Mm-hmm. Like just as she says, the house was his, but he was my home.
Right.
I like how she connects the lover to the environment around her.
Right. Yeah, no, that is good. All right, then. And I will read one more. It's from Ir Haitham. And I know she's in India. And the poem is called Rhythm. Oh, iRhythm. That's what it's called. Okay. So, a cloud was fluffy and white, but I was hunted and falling. My wings were ruined, bearing all damage. I fell in the river where people were near the banks, over the cliffs, yet none seemed to notice, none seemed to care.
I like the rhyme.
Yeah, I like the rhyme, and I like the theme of, because I think it shows up a lot, like you'll see someone in clear distress and you think, help me, and like no one does anything. Like there have been like scientific studies about like when a crisis appears, everyone presumes that the other person will do something, and by everyone presuming that, no one helps when there's a bad situation.
Mm.
Yeah,
I completely understand. I like the way the structure, the way the author structures the words and poems to express the that specific emotions that you've spoken about. I feel like that's amazing.
Mm. Alrighty then, and that concludes today's episode of Insta Poetic Justice. Thank you so much for joining me, Hashim.
Thank you actually for inviting me. It's an honor to be here again.
Yeah, I think we had a wonderful discussion about, again, it was really fascinating to discuss the sort of bilingual nature of your poems, because that is the first non-native English speaker poet that I've been able to have that conversation with about. And I'm very grateful to you. And I think we had a wonderful discussion about John Lupin's poems.
Thank you very much. Really, thank you. Right. Thank you a million times. I really enjoyed with you.
Yeah. Alrighty then. Well, tune in next time, listeners, and I will discuss another Insta Poetry Giant with another poet. Take care, everyone. Bye.